I think there's a few big levers that a storage operator needs to focus on. The website that you have needs to just be easy to use. And that's, this would take a marketing genius to figure that out. Like anyone running a business should know that, you know, you want to make process as easy and frictionless for your customer as possible.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Students of Storage podcast. I'm here with my co-host Tully from the Cubby team. And today we've got a very special guest, Faraz Hamani, who is the founder and CEO of Iron Storage. They own and operate around 35 facilities based out in Houston, Texas, with a pretty broad geographic portfolio. But thanks for taking the time to join us today, Faraz.
Yeah, absolutely, Michael and Tully. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I was really excited for this episode specifically. I've known you for 18 months now, and I just find your story of both your journey into storage and then what you're actively doing today to be quite interesting and compelling. Would you mind just giving our audience the Cliff Notes high level version of how you went from your prior life over to the storage world?
For sure. I appreciate it. My prior life was in technology. I used to work at tech companies like Oracle and Google, which are awesome sounding names. And people ask me, oh, you worked at Google? And I was not one of the brainiacs at Google. I was not the one coding the future of AI or anything like that over there. I was a sales guy there. So I was selling software, and I worked in other programs like revenue management, and I got to meet a lot of really smart people, and I got to see how some of the biggest and best businesses work and they operate and what their processes are and how they hire and how they define success, which was an amazing experience that I think I've carried with me. While I was working at those companies, I was fortunate enough to have a manager actually who, when I got my first sales bonus and I was like a young 20-something year old and I'm like, oh my God, I got $10,000. Let's go party. He's like, hold up, think about investing it in rental properties. And he had a couple rental properties he owned himself. And he showed me the process of, hey, this is how you look at a property and this is how you figure out what it rents for and what kind of repairs or renovations you need to do. And so with his guidance, I bought that first rental property. Then a year later, bought another one and then bought another one and grew to a few rental properties I was managing at the time while keeping my day job. And was fortunate that the market did really, really well and made me and a lot of other people look really smart that owned homes pre-COVID, and the market shot up and we sold pretty much everything, all those homes. And so then was left with the cash and said, okay, I like this real estate thing. I can wrap my head around it. It makes sense. You know, you buy property, you charge X rent and these are expenses. Like it just makes sense to me much, much more than public equities or a lot of other things did. So then we had this cash and said, okay, well, let's try commercial real estate. Let's level up. I guess that's the next thing we're supposed to do. And looked at a lot of other asset types and even did with first commercial real estate deal that I did. We bought a strip center 20 minutes from where I live and then bought a storage facility after that. We really liked the experience of owning that storage facility. And when I say we, I mean, at this point, it was me taking the lead, but you know, I have a partner in this business as well. Then we've started bringing other investors in when we wanted to level up to commercial real estate and needed more cash to cover those purchases. And I really enjoyed the experience of running a storage facility, which I'm sure we're going to dive all into here, but like we geeked out about it. Like it just, we loved it. It was like a small business. There were so many operational levers for us to play around with and fiddle with and get good at. And, you know, we're fortunate enough to have had a good experience on that first one. And now fast forward today, we've built a small business on it. We've got about 30 locations across the country and we continue to learn more about it every day. It's like such a fascinating niche in real estate to talk about self-storage.
Yeah. Absolutely. And me and you have always gotten along pretty well because at Cubby, we're doing what you're doing on the operations side, which is applying stuff that works in other industries and adjacent verticals to self-storage, right? Like that's the name of the game, finding areas of improvement and areas of potential inefficiency. I think one thing that's really unique about your model is you've taken a very remote first approach. So you've got those 30 facilities, but you don't have site managers sitting behind a desk somewhere. And in fact, you don't, as far as I still know, you don't have any full-time US-based employees, basically. So talk to me about, without giving away too much of your secret sauce, talk to me about how you decided to go in a remote first direction, maybe somewhere after facility number one, but before facility number 10, and then what your experience has been like building out that remote-oriented team.
Yeah, absolutely. So we went remote oriented for a few reasons. I think the first is we, and continues to be our focus, we are buying facilities that we feel as operators, we're like the forgotten middle, right? There's some facilities that are large, 40, 50, 60,000 square feet, even 30,000 square feet or above, let's call it. And because they produce a certain amount of revenue on that large square footage, they can afford to absorb certain fixed costs. Like to put it in plain English, Bigger facility means I can afford to have a manager that I put on my payroll and sit there. But in our case, when our average facility is maybe 15 or 20,000 square feet, the economics don't support having someone sit there for 40 hours a week, of which those 40 hours, maybe 7 hours are working and 33 hours of them sitting waiting for a customer to walk. Right? Our facilities can't afford those. But that creates opportunity then, right? Because then only certain types of buyers who are willing and able and have the capabilities to manage a facility remotely are the ones competing on those assets. And we get a lot of good deals because we get to take kind of a large, sophisticated operator playbook, but apply it to these assets that sophisticated operators can't always go after. And it gives us a nice little edge in our niche within that niche of self-storage. But the other reason is exactly what I said earlier, right? Things have changed. Pre-COVID, a lot of customers expected to walk into any business and interact with a human and get what you need. But then when COVID happened and we had these lockdowns, everything became contactless, right? The pizza driver doesn't hand you a pizza anymore. He leaves it at your front door, and everything became a self-checkout process. And the customer, from a user experience point of view, became used to that. And so that created this opportunity we felt in self-storage. We said, hey, even customers who traditionally want to walk in and talk to a manager, I think they've become accustomed to not doing that and just going and paying online or calling somebody, talking on the phone or renting on a website. And this might be a good opportunity or a good moment in time to take that and apply that across our storage portfolio and storage operations. And the advantage of running things that way is you're running much leaner, right? Cut payroll from 40 hours a week down to maybe 4 or 5 hours a week. And in those 4 or 5 hours, they're all high leverage tasks where there's no wasted time in those 4 or 5 hours when we send somebody out to our property, like one of our managers out. And so we run a lot leaner and unlocks the ability to buy properties that we probably could not buy because their economics did not support a full-time manager. And I think we found a really good niche in just doing that, good little space for us.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, your growth has been pretty phenomenal as a company, as a portfolio in the past. Even since I've known you, you've really scaled the portfolio. And talk to us a little bit more about that in terms of how you're taking learnings at 4 facilities and then applying them when you're doubling to 8 facilities and then doubling again to 15 and then continuing to grow the portfolio. Talk to us about how you're applying those lessons at scale.
Yeah, I mean, we just screw up and it's like, okay, let's not try to make the same mistake 2 or 3 times if possible. And that's why I'm saying, like, I think we're still learning a lot every single day because there continue to be things that we're like, oh, we could have done that better, or we could have probably avoided this problem had we done X, Y, and Z. And I think that's what 90% of our operations today are probably just a reaction to a past screw up that we've made. So I think the big thing that we learned, though, and I talked to a lot of other operators, as you scale up more and more, systems and technology and standardization become super, super important. So I'll put it this way. Like, when we had 2 facilities, it wasn't too bad because I had 2 part-time managers that I needed to go send tasks to. If they needed to text me a question, I could reply. If one of them wanted to submit the completion of his tasks by just texting them to me, that was cool. And if the other guy wanted to email them to me, that's fine. Or if one guy wanted to call me and ask me this question, it was okay. I didn't need to have a lot of standardization. I was managing 2 different people at 2 facilities. Problem is, as we grow to 4, 5, 6, 7, and now 30, I can't have 1 person that wants to call me and ask me questions, 1 person that wants to text me, and 1 person that wants to email me on Sunday nights, and 1 person that wants to write me. I need a little bit of it becomes hard to stay on top of. And as we grow, and I think the common theme that we've seen that is kind of the key to success and scaling is I need to, as much as possible, without sacrificing quality at a site and without making our, you know, a robotic relationship between us and our employees and contractors and all of that, we want to have standardization. We want to make sure that everyone is held to a certain high standard of what we expect in terms of care for the facility, what we expect in terms of communication, both internally or to a customer or to a third-party vendor. And we want to make sure the same things are getting done at every property without falling to the cracks. It's tough now at this scale when we have 35 properties to be like, hey, did we make sure that we got the leaves raked and blown off the properties at property number 17? Like, we don't have time to sit there and think about these one-off questions for every property. We need to make sure... We need to have confidence in the assumption that it's getting done. And to do that, we need to have a standard system that is in place for execution and for checks and balances and for reviews. And a lot of things that we might have thought was foolish or unnecessary, or we don't need to be that nitty gritty or nitpicky about things. You learn that at a certain scale, you have to be. It's the only way to survive. Otherwise, you're just reacting all the time. And that's probably the biggest theme in all of the lessons we've learned scaling up over the years.
Yeah. And you all have done such a good job of that. It's truly impressive to watch from my seat in the house. If you were talking to, say, a 10 facility operator with a site manager everywhere that's been in business for 20, 30, 40 years, and they're going to look at standardizing some processes and making things a little smoother with technology, or just optimizing things and finding bottlenecks. Talk to the audience a bit about how you go about, or how you would go about finding the areas of like inefficiency to tighten up, regardless of the model that you run.
Yeah, I think you work backwards, honestly, from like, okay, my ideal state of a storage facility. What are like, if I did a site visit and I wanted to walk away with saying, wow, everything is perfect, we nailed it, what would that look like? For me, you know, I would say things like, we have a really clean facility. There's no trash or debris left. Every unit is accounted for. If it's a vacant unit, we've tagged it and done what we need to make sure that it's ready for the next customer. It would be that there's no deferred repairs or maintenance. It would be that we haven't had a break-in event in a long time. So think about like your ideal states. What are the things that you would love to see if the storage facility is running perfectly? And then you got to work backwards from, okay, what do I need to do to ensure that we're able to achieve that outcome, like at least 95% of the time? What do I need to do to make sure our facility is clean at least 95, 98, 99% of the time? And what do I need to make sure we're avoiding break-ins almost all the time? What do I need to make sure that our unit inventory is done correctly? And so that's a lot of what we did, right? And those answers might be different from operator to operator, like what is their ideal thing or what is the pain point they're trying to solve? But we'll start from there and then work backwards. If my property has a cleanliness problem and every time I go there, there's tons of trash, then I need to have a system, not only a system that I can go hand to my manager, right? To say, hey, someone might think, okay, your facility's dirty, just go tell your manager to clean it. That's fine, right? Multiply that across 10 facilities and 10 managers. You have two options. Either you should going to trust that all 10 people are just going to go on their lunch break and all that and take a broom and sweep up and they're just going to do what you told them to do, or you need to have a way to make sure there's checks and balances. It can't be like a couple months go by and then I decide to go drive to facility 8 and I'm like, hey, it's not clean, but I told you 3 months ago to make sure you clean it, right? It doesn't work that way, right? You have to have some system of, not only have you given, you have to give that manager a plan for execution, but then you as the operator and owner need to have a system of checks and balances. And that's the most important part of implementing any system. So for us, what we do is, hey, we tell our managers, you need to keep the place clean. And every single month, we are going to ask you to go take pictures of the critical areas of the storage facility, which is going to be your drive aisles and units and gate and office area, and send us pictures to make sure that they're clean. And if every time you send us 3 pictures in a row where there's no areas for improvements and everything looks good, we're going to give you a small bonus. And that's our system of checks and balances, right? And now I don't have to think about all the time, are 10 facilities clean? I just go and look, did we get picture uploads for all 10 properties this month? If I'm missing one, I know who to call. If there's constant areas of improvement on one, every time we check them, I know what I need to address. And so think about it that way. Like, you got to think about your outcome, what you're hoping to achieve, then give the manager a system, which is easy for them to follow, but then you need to back that up with a system of checks and balances so that you can stay on top of 10 plus properties as well.
Tully and I talk to all sorts of operators that run all sorts of different models, but I think we consistently see the best operators are the ones that have a plan, implement that plan, and then hold people accountable to whatever it is that is important at the facility. And again, different facilities might have different issues, right? One might be really dirty. One might have terrible online rentals. One might have really high delinquency. I think actions follow incentives, right? Like outcomes follow incentives. If we hold people accountable, that'll be super helpful.
I was going to say, going to have to get that template.
Put it behind a little like paywall for a newsletter or something.
I'm happy to share it. That's one of the cool things about the storage industry is everyone's so forthcoming. You said like, oh, don't share the sauce. But like everybody shares the sauce. And it's not even the sauce that's so important. It's like your willingness to go and actually do the work and execute it. But I mean, I learned so much from talking to other people, and we're all learning from our screw ups, right? So I'll just talk to other, you know, I have a break-in problem in one facility. So I had to talk to another operator, dude, what do I do? He's like, oh, let me tell you about these 10 wild break-in stories I have. And here's how I eventually fixed the problem, right? And so that's how we all continue to get better and learn.
Just kind of like focusing on the remote aspect of your business, which is your entire business. What would you say is the most challenging thing that you've encountered? And maybe what was the most challenging thing when you started? And what is the most challenging thing that you're still facing to this day?
The hardest part of remote management is like just the plain, painfully obvious one. Like it sucks not having a person available at your property at a moment's notice whenever you need something, right? Customer comes in sometimes, says, hey, I can't get my unit door to open. I've tried everything. And we can troubleshoot as much as we can over the phone. But God, wouldn't it have been so much easier if I could just say, well, there's a manager 20 feet over there sitting there. Just grab him or her. He'll help you out, right? Or we see a piece of trash and you left a mattress and it's sitting there on our security cameras and we can see it. And I've got to call somebody to come pick it up and move it out of the aisle. And it's just sitting there in the main driveway for the whole day. Like, wouldn't it be so amazing if I just had a manager sitting 20 feet away to go deal with it? So That's the thing. People, especially people that are new to the storage world, are like, oh, it's easy. I'll just remote manage. Everyone does it, right? But it's really hard not having a person sitting there to handle every crisis that comes up. In fact, it makes you realize how many little things actually go wrong when you don't have a person there who can just go deal with most of it, right? Like if you have a manager sitting there, there's so many things that they would go and just take care of without you ever even knowing that it happened. But because you don't have a person there, you're going to be made aware of every little thing that's going on that you have to go call a person for. And so it's tough. But again, that goes back to the system that forces you to be really organized. It forces you to have a proactive system of monitoring your properties, right? Because there's no manager sitting there that's going to call me and say, hey, I noticed that this thing was sitting on the aisle. No one's going to tell me that. I've got to be able to go proactively look at it myself. Otherwise, maybe I'm waiting a week because my manager maybe shows up only 1 or 2 days a week part-time. In our model, I don't want a mattress sitting out there for a week, and, you know, and it took a week for somebody to tell me about it. I want to be proactive about it. And so I think that's the challenging part of remote management. Because you don't have someone there to just deal with every little thing that can pop up, you in turn have to be very proactive about monitoring a property that might be 1,000 miles away and having systems in place to go deal with issues that pop up really quickly. And I think that was the hardest part, even when I first got started. Just everything felt like we were reacting to something. Customer is trying to get into the gate. It's not working. I'm like, okay, well, we're going to have to call somebody out. I need something right now. And it's just that times 100. And customer can't get into his unit. Well, I need to get in right now. I'm like, sorry, I don't have anyone there right now. And, you know, as a new operator, I was just like, oh my God, we're making customers so upset. Like, we're doing such a bad job of running this place, it feels like. And so that's, again, it forces you to then learn, be like, okay, well, I don't like getting these calls. I don't like our customer service team having to deal with angry customers. We want to deliver a really good customer experience. We want our customers to be happy. So then it goes back to, again, we're learning from our screw-ups. What do we need to do to make sure that these things stop happening? What do we need to be more proactive about? And then from there, systems and better. And I think that's how we've gotten more and more comfortable in that world of remote management.
Great answer.
Let's switch gears a little bit, because something I wanted to make sure that we touch on is the marketing side of things. And that's everything from websites to SEO to PPC to other creative advertising. But like, in terms of our audience, in terms of like a podcast guest, you're kind of a unicorn as far as I've met traveling to all these conferences and stuff, but you have the experience of working at places like Google and coming from a technology background, and then you're applying that to a remote self-service almost model for customers in terms of being able to rent units, pay their bill, and so on. Can you tell us about early on how you set up the foundation for your web presence to be what you wanted it to be, and then just some more learning down the line of what you've been kind of rolling in on top of it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny because people always in the storage world say, oh, you used to work at Google. Can you tell me, like, ask them to go make my site rank higher? Like, can you tell me why they're not putting my ads up there? And I'm like, dude, if I knew how to do that, I wouldn't be running storage facilities, man. I'd be doing
there's some Wizard of Oz behind the counter. Yeah. Pulling Google search.
Yeah, exactly. It happens all the time. Like the other day I was wearing one of my Google Cloud shirts. I just walked outside of my office. Someone's like, oh, you work at Google? I'm like, no, I used to. Like, oh, dude, can you like tell them to verify my account or something? I'm like, dude, like, who do you think I am, man? But anyways, digital marketing, yeah, I've learned a lot. I think same thing, through a lot of trial and error and just seeing what works and what doesn't work and where's the best return on effort and time and money in marketing, because there's a lot of different things and it's hard to know where to start a lot of times, right? Like you, in your question, you just asked me, rattled off like PPC and SEO, and there's so many acronyms that your first hurdle as an operator in storage is like, I have to learn what these things mean. And then I have to figure out where I want to spend time and money. And then maybe I decide I want to hire an agency and a marketing agency to deal with it. But then the issue is like, how do I know they're even doing a good job? Because I don't understand what they're supposed to be doing. How do I know if they're doing it well or not doing it well? And the agency tells me it's going to take you 6 months to see any results on SEO. So am I supposed to sit there? And it's so difficult. I think it's such a black box. And so I posted about this on LinkedIn the other day. I think through trial and error and through also a little bit of common sense, I think there's a few big levers that a storage operator needs to focus on in 2025. First is the website that you have needs to just be easy to use. And that doesn't take a marketing genius to figure that out. Like anyone running a business should know that, you know, you want to make process as easy and frictionless for your customer as possible. It's a big reason that actually we moved over to Cubby. And Michael, you know what I'm talking about, right? It was part of our conversations. We hated being on a storage website where a customer wants to rent a unit and we make them fill out like a 30-form questionnaire before they're allowed to rent. And we're asking them for and upload your driver's license and tell me, like, here, give us the name of your firstborn son and like all these questions. And the customer's just trying to rent like a $60 storage unit, right? And we don't buy anything online that way. Like, when is the last time, like, if you went to Amazon and they made you fill out 30 questions to go buy a pair of sneakers or whatever, like, you wouldn't buy it, right? In fact, that's why Amazon does so well, because they make it like too easy to buy something, right? Like, that's why I have Amazon packages showing up in my house every day. And I'm like, it's like, I don't even remember ordering this one because it's so easy. It's one click. So our question was like, how can we make the storage experience start to feel like that a little bit and make it feel like how everything else feels in 2025? And that's one big reason, as we mentioned, we like Cubby a lot because their experience mirrors more what it feels like to buy anything online. What's your name, phone number, email, run your credit card. And then after you've made your purchase, we'll ask you all these other questions. We can fill out your lease, but let's get a really quick action to conversion. So that part, get a user to be able to really quickly convert in the conversion process, but also make it really like a nice, friendly looking website where even grandma can look at it and figure out what units you have and how much it costs. And she knows where to click for rent now. That's the first part. And I think that's the foundational part. Because you can go spend all the money and nail everything else on marketing, but marketing is directing everyone to your website. And if you haven't nailed the website, you're wasting your marketing dollars, right? If I'm doing a great job of bringing 100 people to my site every day, but my conversion process is so crappy that 90 of them drop out, I'm wasting money. After that, I would say the other things to focus on, and I can go on forever, but I'll keep it short. I think the biggest thing we see today is what we call, it's referred to maybe as local SEO, local search engine optimization. When you Google, like, I'm trying to go eat a Mexican restaurant near me or something like that, and you look it up, the first thing you look at is all the businesses that pop up. What are their stars? How many reviews? How many ratings? You click on them. You look at some pictures. That is how people are searching for local businesses for the most part. That area is where you need to spend a lot of time on your ranking. You need to be getting lots of reviews on Google. You need to be posting lots of pictures to Google. You need to be responding to those reviews in a timely manner. And you need to be doing whatever you can to improve the optimization of that Google business profile. That is where the vast majority of your leads are coming in. And of course, there's so much other stuff you can do. But if I was an operator and I was talking to an operator and they were like, tell me where to focus on. It's those two things. Nail your website, nail your conversion process, and spend a lot of effort on that Google business profile. And that'll get you 70 or 80% of the way there.
Thank you for sharing that, Faraz. To that end, like, you don't need to go it alone. I think even when I joined the storage industry here at Cubby, I didn't have any background in online marketing or SEO or PPC. There's lots of self-help resources out there on YouTube and other places like that about what these terms mean and what are some basic levers you can pull yourself. And then beyond that, there's lots of storage specific vendors, consultants, et cetera, that really know what best practices look like. And you can leverage their expertise for a reasonable return on cost there. So don't feel like you're going at it alone. We're going to ISS Las Vegas next week, and it's just a crazy environment at some of these trade shows. It's hard to drink from the fire hose and know really what you need to do. But thank you for giving kind of those two actionable points of, okay, let's look at my website setup. A simple exercise you can do is go through current website checkout process and just see how easy or difficult it is for you to do. I think a lot of groups that we talk to haven't done that in a while. But all these little things, and it's not necessarily I need to change my tech or my systems, but what are some little levers that I can pull? Do I really need to ask these four extra questions in my sign up flow? Things like that. Tully, I know you have some kind of thoughts on online marketing and websites.
I think obviously Google My Business Profile is super important, but it's not the only place that we search. And I think a lot of operators tend to forget about that. I'm curious if there's any tools that you found super effective. I think it's Localese by Neurostar like comes to mind, which is a tool that allows you to manage your Yelp profile, your Apple Business Profile, and your Google My Business Profile, as well as a handful of others. I'm not sure if you could speak to that or maybe some other kind of more niche things that folks might not be thinking about that do have a broader impact on how tenants might be finding them.
Yeah, I mean, I'll put it this way. There's so many niche things that you can do to try to improve how many places you are present online. The list is like endless. You mentioned Apple Maps, Yelp, Foursquare, 100 other websites, EB, Better Business Bureau. And I get questions like that all the time. Like, hey, is it worth listing on the BBB? Or hey, should I get my storage facility put on the Chamber of Commerce for my city and this and that? And I think what helps operators is if you can zoom out and understand why these things matter in the first place. And at a really basic high level, what signals are you sending to Google? Like, why does Google care that you're on the BBB? Like, why does that matter? And so the way to zoom out and think about it is this. Google's task is this. Somebody searches for storage units near me. They search for anything, right? And Google's job is to determine, here are the businesses or here are the links that I should show the user And Google's job is to determine which links are, one, the most relevant to that user. Like, which one is the user most likely to click on and be like, oh, this is actually the thing I was looking for. This solves my problem. And second job Google has is, what's the most credible link? They don't want to put something up to something that's scammy or something that's a business that's not reliable. Like, they want people to have a good time, like, enjoy their experience on Google. Right? That's Google's job. If you search for something, Google wants to be able to really quickly give you, I think this is the exact thing you needed, and here's a really legitimate business to handle it. So those are the two signals you need to nail. So when it comes to relevancy, that's where a lot of that SEO work comes in, that makes sure that your webpage mentions the city that you're in a lot and says, hey, storage units in Sheboygan or storage units in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or wherever it might be. And make sure you have lots of relevant content. You talk about climate control storage and all of these things. And so that at least sends the signal to Google, hey, this is exactly what that person was searching for. They look for storage units in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and our site is storage units in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And we have lots of pictures of storage units and all of them. Then the second part is credibility. How does Google know that you are a credible business? And that's where all of these other things come into play, that, hey, well, not only do I have my website, but I'm on Apple Maps, I'm on Google Maps, I'm on Yelp, I'm on Foursquare, I'm on the Better Business Bureau, I'm in my local Chamber of Commerce, I have 105 star reviews, I got reviews that are as recent as last week. In these reviews, people are talking about how great the experience is renting from storage for me. And as many signals as you can send to Google to be like, hey, not only is this business exactly what the customer is looking for, but it's really credible. And there's evidence that suggests, even as recent as last week with the most recent review that was last, people were confirming this is a credible business. That's when Google decides, okay, you know what? I think I'm going to go ahead and show them this result. And I'll probably show them this result over this other person's storage facility because they're not sending as many signals to Google as this one is. And so signing up for as many of those little free citations as you can is good, because that's like basically Better Business Bureau telling Google, yeah, I vouch for this guy. Their storage facility is on here. And Apple Maps is saying, yeah, I vouch for this guy. And Yelp is saying, I vouch for this guy. And Google's saying, okay, well, I don't know Iron Storage, but there seems to be 100 credible websites that also mention them out there. So I'm going to go ahead and assume they're credible. And that is at the high level how all this search engine optimization and stuff works. And so when you think about it from that lens, that gives you an idea of like, okay, should I be on Yelp? Should I be here? Should I be there? Should I be there? Yes, go to any website that's credible. That'll give you an opportunity to mention your website on there. And think about it that way. If I sign up and put my business on this website, what kind of signal do I think that's sending to Google? And then that's how you kind of make those decisions.
Awesome. I think last question I have at the top of mind, and then we can wrap up. Really appreciate all the time today. But I think where these two things overlap is when it comes to lead conversion. So you've driven interest to your website or driven somebody to call you by ranking highly, and then your operations folks are then talking to that person and trying to convert them into a lead. Can you talk about a few of the KPIs that you like to track for your team? And just the impact that they've had on the business? Like, I don't want to lead you down a path, but any sort of KPIs around leads and converting them in this like soft kind of demand environment that we're in?
Yeah, 100%. I think obviously that there's, and at least in our business, there's two ways that you can convert a rental. Somebody comes on your website, rents a unit, or somebody goes on your website and starts the process or then calls you. And then you have a human on your team that intervenes and tries to finish the web. So the closer in either case is either your website or a human. When it comes to the website, again, we already talked about it. Make sure your website is as conversion optimized as possible. But beyond that, there's not much you can do, right? If a customer is trying to go through the web experience, they decide not to rent. One more can you do except try to go, like Cubby has that cool feature, right? That if someone starts a rental, but they don't finish, it at least gives you as the operator, hey, this person with this name and this email started a rental, but didn't finish. You can follow up. There's not much, I can't coach my website to be better or anything, right? But what I can do is coach my people. And so a lot of the KPIs, a lot of the work that we do is around if a human intervenes, if we get an inbound call from somebody saying they want to rent a unit, or we're doing a follow-up on someone that maybe reserved a unit, how can we train our reps to do as good of a job as possible to close that lead? And so the first thing it starts with, I think, in my opinion, is you got to measure it. You got to add. And this is a ton of operators don't do this. It's not easy. It's not easy to get all these metrics. But when I say measure it, I need to know for our team, I can tell you for each sales rep that we have or each customer service rep, how many leads, how many people did they talk to about renting a storage unit and how many of those people did they close? And if we're not measuring that, then one, I don't know where my strengths and weaknesses are within my own team. I don't know where the areas of improvement. I don't know, you know, are we even doing a good job? Are we not? And again, it's you have to nail these things, even more important than marketing, in my opinion, because we can do a great job of bringing 100 leads in. But if I'm only closing 20 of them every time because we haven't done a good job on lead conversion, I'm wasting that marketing money, like pointless. I'm just setting it on fire. Right. So first is measuring it. making sure that you can say for each person on your team, I know their close rate and I know who my best closers are. And then it's going to be empowering those reps. Once you can measure it, then I would say, honestly, another great thing we did was incentivize them, right? We get bonuses. Hey, for the people on our team that are closing and have a great close rate, we're going to pay you more. When we started doing that, we saw like 10% jump in our conversion rate. Like plain English, when we started bonusing our people, if we used to get 100 phone calls from 100 tenants, we used to maybe close 45 of them. Now we've close to 60 of them. We're squeezing 15 more rentals on every 100 leads out just because we decided to start paying our reps on their close rate. Best money we've ever spent, honestly, in my opinion. But then last thing you have to do is you have to empower then those reps, right? You can't just tell them, hey, go be better at closing. You got to give them the tools to go do that. And in our opinion, it's a few things, right? Some kind of a guide or script is helpful. There needs to be a constant QA feedback process. Somebody needs to be listening to those calls, right? Because each sales rep on your team might have different things that they struggle with, right? We may need to talk to one rep and just be like, hey, just slow it down and be more conversational. We need to talk to another rep and say, hey, give some more thought and time to your end. When somebody asks, where are you located? Like take the time to go look at Google Maps and ask them where they are and help them find out how to get from A to B. And so there's different things you have to coach them on, and then give them other tools as well. Like we give a lot of latitude to our reps to offer discounts where they think is needed, offer promotions. We just basically tell them, and I even tell them, hey, if there's anything else you think of live while you're on the call that it might take to get that customer to rent, just send me a message and I will do my best to get back to you in a minute or two, because I don't want that customer to get off the phone. If we had a chance of closing them and we had an idea of how to do it, then we should take a swing at it. So make sure your reps feel empowered and have that latitude. And everyone has a common understanding that we have this goal. When people call us, we don't want to walk away without that rental. And we're going to do everything within reasonable power and all of that to go rental. And if you can empower them to do that and incent them and train them and let them see their own results and measure it, you're going to have a really powerful system of lead conversion.
Absolutely. And something in there, measure everything, but something in there that's very easy upgrade that I recommend to folks all the time is if you're answering the phone in 2025 with like a desk phone at every facility that doesn't record or give you any information, you can't, to your point, track what isn't there. So even upgrading to like a VoIP or an internet phone solution, they're very economical. It's pretty commoditized at this point. They're pretty cheap and they allow you to do all this sort of stuff around recording and then AI, like transcription and call grading and stuff. This all can be had for like not much money in the scheme of things. So I think just setting back to your earlier point about setting up systems that allow you to hold people accountable, track things, and then improve on where they do. And then one other thing, I'd love to hear if you've thought about this and experimented with it, or if you do it already, this notion of specialization is actually something that I hear a lot more about. You've got 10 reps, 3 are really good at closing, the rest are very friendly and can help current customers with their problem, like process payment, et cetera. But how do we get as many of those leads to those sales closers, the killers, versus the folks who might not be as good at, for whatever reason, some people are shy, whatever, but have you done any sort of specialization among your team?
Yeah, it is a good question because it's true. Like invariably, there's going to be some people on your team that are just better closers than others, right? There's just parts of a person's personality that you cannot coach in some people and it just makes them better at closing. I think my advice to folks who are thinking about it, and we do a little bit of it, the challenge it comes with is it makes you really have to be intentional about how you're managing your bandwidth, right? Because you have to think of it this way. I have 10 reps. I have 3 of them I think are really good closers. So I'm like, okay, all the new rental calls will go to these 3 people and everything else will go to the others. There may be some days where those 3 are sitting there with nothing to do and the other 7 are getting like blown up with calls or vice versa. And by not managing that bandwidth properly, you can sometimes create a suboptimal customer experience as well, because you may have customers sitting on hold waiting for payment call and you have 3 reps that are sitting there doing that. So long story short, it can be done. Probably a net good thing to put your best closers on the most high value phone calls. And we do that as well, but it requires you to be really then intentional. You can't just set it and forget it with your call center. You have to really watch and stay on top of call volume and everything. Otherwise you might be shooting yourself in the foot and creating worse customer experience. You might have sales leads that are waiting on hold for 15 minutes because there's only 3 people that are assigned to those calls. And that's way, way worse. I would rather just have all 10 reps take the call there. So if you're not being intentional about managing bandwidth, you might be hurting yourself more than you're helping yourself when you do something like that.
Yeah, that's a great call out. This was great. Thank you so much for taking the time. I think a lot of folks will get a lot of interesting nuggets out of this that they can apply to their business.
No, I feel like we just got the tip of the iceberg. So I imagine we'll probably have future conversations, dive a little bit deeper.
Yeah, I hope so. You guys gave me a microphone and let me geek out about storage, which I always appreciate doing. So Thank you. I hope it was helpful.
Well, thanks for us. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for us.
Thank you for listening to Students of Storage. Links to any of the resources we chatted about in the episode can be found in the show notes. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe just so that you don't miss out on any future episodes. Hope to see you back here soon.